Okay, might make a start. Seem to be reasonably free of the obvious troublemakers, so we'll get going before they get here. Fortunately, I'm up against a kernel-level talk, so most of the obvious people have gone to the other one. All right, to help any confusion and to give you time to flee to another talk, I'm not talking about embedded hardware here. I'm talking about small software installations. Now, I am talking about making them small enough you can probably fit them on embedded hardware, but hardware sort of scares me. So I got Linux onto my iPack, but I didn't really know what I was doing. I just followed the instructions. So this talk is mostly about small software installations. It's also purely a fun talk. Anyone getting anything out of this talk and going back and using it in their job should feel very guilty. This is just a fun project sort of thing for me that I just fool around with in my home time, mostly as a way just to learn about Linux. Sure. This is a bit better. You still hear me up the back? Yep. Cool. So, like I said, this is pretty much just going to be a fun talk. Get you a bit inspired to go out and maybe tool around with some of this stuff just for your own personal edification. Can turn into fairly time-consuming. I've sort of accidentally lost entire weekends rebuilding one piece of software just to try and make it work with the small installation, but you get that some of the time. Like I said, it is possible to use the sort of things I'm talking about here to fit Linux onto your small embedded system, but I'm not really an expert on that. There was meant to be a hardware embedded talk here, but that guy pulled out at the last minute for whatever reason. But he's certainly not me. Different people have different ideas of what a small installation might be. For some people, it might be they've got a desktop machine with 32 meg or 16 meg or 64 meg of RAM. They just want to make their favorite Debian or Red Hat installation work on it. You may have small disk drives. You may have picked up an i486 somewhere in a garbage heap or bought one for about $20 at the local computer swap meet. That's probably a bit too big for what I'm talking about. All that memory, gosh, what would you do with it? It's still kind of interesting. Like, I've listed a few sort of things at the front there that you can kind of do. Replace the sort of obvious desktops with things like SSCE, pick a smaller browser. It's pretty easy to get a very responsive desktop in 32 meg that basically does everything you might want to do elsewhere. Didn't put the obvious one up there of replace Emacs with Vi, but I guess that's sort of a given. It's still also that sort of, even if you did those 4 points I've listed at the top there, you're still using a fair bit of disk space. Like, that's kind of assuming you're using a fairly normal X server and stuff like that. You're still sort of using over 100 megs of disk space on a fairly featureful system. So again, all that disk space, my gosh. I'm talking more about the things like down the bottom. You want to have a little boot floppy sort of quick, my Cisco router's blown up, I just want to turn this box into a Linux router for a little while we get it replaced, or I want to have a little one disk firewall, some kind of forensics disk for if you've had a break-in on your home machine or at the office or something and you just want to boot up, get a system that you can DD the disk off to another box, or have a look at what's actually gone on without destroying what's on the hard drive in any way. Rescue disk, which I haven't put there, something like Tom's root boot disk. It's an obvious example of a very tiny distribution, fits on a 1.4 meg floppy. Something like a Linux video recorder, where you might, again, if you come into cheap hardware somehow, or free hardware even, it's getting pretty hard to buy 486s these days, but people are giving them away. Or even some kind of lower powered machine. You want to, you don't want to necessarily waste too much disk if you're doing something like a Linux video recorder. Say you've got a hardware encoding card and a TV capture card and stuff like that. you don't want to blow too much of that disk space on the operating system. Just have the minimal amount there that you need. But at the same time, you need more than you're going to put on your firewall or your forensics disk, because you probably want to play stuff back and maybe have some kind of graphical interface on your TV screen that you can use your infrared remote control with. So that's one level up from the top view. But again, a small installation is nice. And if you ever go crazy and mass produce these things, then having a small installation is also good. And then there's the sort of developer desktop for a very low-end machine. The guy who wrote, anyone here use Window Maker as their window manager? A few people, good. Good to see you owning up. The guy who wrote that in Portugal basically developed it all on a 486, which is the reason it runs so speedily. Because if you think it becomes at all slow on your Pentium, imagine what it must look like on his 486. So if you're looking at it, it's very clean. It actually runs quite speedily because this guy developed on a very less than featureful machine. A few kernel developers have gone on record as sort of mentioning their main work desktop machine is not big and grunty. Linus went the other way the other day, but Andrew Morton has said, for example, his desktop machine is not that big and grunty, and the reason being that if he's building on it and running Linux on it under normal load, he wouldn't actually mind if it's under load a bit, because then you start to see the corner cases that they're trying to get out of things. Alan Cox had a machine for a long time that was 8 megabytes, and that was pretty good for torture tests. Apparently it blew up a year or so ago and is no longer with us, but it can be useful to see how things are going. So I want to go even smaller. Like, I want to go down to the level of the last few slides, something that fits on one disk. So I'm basically going to be talking about a couple of things, one of which is BusyBox. Who's heard of BusyBox before? Who actually consciously uses it in day-to-day? Right, so a few people. Okay, cool. Maybe more of you use it than you actually realize, because it was originally written for Debian boot disks as a way of just packing a whole bunch, a fairly featureful Linux installation onto a disk or two. Mostly maintained nowadays by a guy called Eric Anderson. Well, he's sort of head cat herder. He runs his own consulting company now called Copilot Consulting. Did a fair bit of work with Linio, particularly on getting embedded Linux into a phone called the Tux phone, which was a little video phone. And the mailing list for BusyBox is actually quite a good one if you're wanting to learn at all about writing fairly small code and software development. Fairly friendly list. Get the occasional newbie question, very few flame wars, and lots of fairly high quality coding. There's not the signal to noise ratio is pretty good on that list. And consequently, there's a lot of people who contributed to BusyBox because it's actually a fairly welcoming community. If you throw something out there that's useful, it'll get included after a while. There's a certain initiation by rite of fire thing involved, but once you get through that, no worries. The whole idea of BusyBox is it's one binary that when you call it, it looks at what name was I called by, essentially in C looking at argv0. So you build this one binary BusyBox, and you link to it. You link ls to it. You link tar to it. You link cp to it. So when you call it as cp, it copies files. When you call it as ls, lists files. Call it as dd, does a data dump. So it's a reasonably cool idea. The idea being that so many of these applications have large, mostly in many cases, common code. Argument parsing, certain amounts of initialization, talking to disk, all sorts of I/O stuff, bit of memory management. You only get those once in BusyBox, and everything can use it. I think if you turn everything on, you get nearly 200 applications in BusyBox, which is not bad. Maybe a bit more than 200 at the moment. It sort of depends on, there's some very bleeding edge stuff that's in 1 week and out the next in the CVS. So it's, yeah, well, yes. Yeah, I should point out, some of these things are not things you may expect in a little thing. There's a dpackage implementation that's basically just to get inside your devs. There's a little RPM implementation just to get inside your RPMs. It's the real Swiss Army knife type application here. Certainly not the Unix philosophy of just do one thing and do it well. It's just do everything and try and do it in a little amount of space. Yes, it's a lot like Emacs, but much, much smaller. And it has its own editor too, just like I've heard Emacs does. So, yes. So in case people didn't hear, Grant's comment was the BusyBox Ash is actually better than the normal Ash you might get. So it supports tab completion, for example, so it's just a bit easier. It is, but anyway, if you turn everything on, you get a couple of hundred things, most of which, well, I don't use them in normal sysadmin life very often. So if I'm building a particular single-purpose style box, like a video recorder or a little firewall box, probably don't need so many of these. So naturally, they made it very, very configurable. And initially, there was a bit of futzing around. We had opened up the makefile from hell and edited about three screens full of yes, no style, do you want these things? About 8 or 12 months ago, they went to the Linux kernel build system, the 2.4 style build system, not the Eric Raymond version, the kbuild 1, essentially. So now you just go make menu config. It looks like you're building your Linux kernel to the point where you look inside the make files and you have Linux kernel comments in there, which is a bit misleading. but that actually makes it quite familiar. It's just run through the normal menus and tack on what you want. And the default build's not too bad, actually, here. And finally, the last thing, just to give you a sort of preview of what's going on there. All the common functionalities in there, they actually have this libbb that made as part of the build process and then statically linked in. Anyone who posts something to the mailing list that doesn't use what's in libbb, even if they possibly had no way of knowing it was in libbb, gets told pretty quickly. There's sort of lots of tricks. But it's a very big library, so it's quite easy to write code and then show it to someone who knows what's in libbb and discover that you've sort of reinvented the wheel about 14 times in 16 lines of code. I mean, these guys are scary, right? Like they, the ultimate story here is about 6 months ago, someone posted a basically a little dot applet for BusyBox, which all it does is when your device is booting up, which can take quite a long time on a slow processor if it's got to unpack CRAMFS or something, it just goes dot, dot, dot every couple of seconds so that you know it hasn't completely exploded. This guy, like he used 180 bytes or something when he built this into the BusyBox, which given that sort of a normal BusyBox might be 300K, you might think, well, what's the big deal? Well, the default setting on the mailing list is if you post code, you're just going to be told no, make it smaller. And after about 2.5 weeks of backwards and forwards, they got this dot down to about 73 bytes. So they, and his first attempt wasn't bad. Like it was, he was using it in embedded devices and it fit. But just on principle, they had to squeeze every last byte out of it. And I got to say, it's not something you'd show to people learning to code C, this BusyBox. Most of it is pretty understandable, but every now and then there's some really cool optimization tricks. Well, cool in the aren't we cool sense, not in the aren't we understandable sense. I just build it with fairly standard options turned on, nothing special. I didn't necessarily optimize for space. I think I actually used minus 02, so maybe a bit bigger than the absolute smallest build here. 375K linked against glibc, which so you instantly are suspecting I haven't necessarily done so well there, because glibc is 8.5 megabytes. Kind of, you lose your savings fairly quickly. All of those libraries that's linked against libc, libm, libcrypt are all part of the glibc distribution. And again, just as a bit of a sort of back of the envelope calculation, looking at those particular packages that I built in, all 116 of them listed on the bottom, not all of which necessarily exist on my box, but came to about a bit over 5.5 meg. Now, admittedly, some of those weren't stripped. About, I think, a third of them were non-stripped binaries, so there's a little bit of saving to be made there. But again, they're all linked against glibc too, so the 8.5 meg is common. But it looks much more impressive if you take away this 8.5 meg here, because it's an order of magnitude saving. But unfortunately, you need the library. If I was just doing something that needed BusyBox, yes? We get to it in a few slides. Yep. That'd be part two. If you're just building something like a rescue floppy or maybe a little firewall, something like that, you can probably get away with static linking, particularly if it's just BusyBox on your box. Like at that point, why bother with dynamic linking? If you've got a couple of other applications, it starts to become that you've got to actually work it out a bit carefully whether static linking gains your stuff or not. And I'm sort of assuming here you're building special purpose style things, so you don't need to cater for the world necessarily. So statically link it. I'm still under a meg in size. And it runs pretty well. It's kind of cool. You just start up the BusyBox Ash and run all the other stuff. They're pretty similar to GNU tools. Like they're missing a few crazy options. And I think the first time I built this, ls wouldn't run for some reason. Didn't know about the current directory. I could do ls of any other directory, but if the one I was in just went, no, that's not how you use ls. But it is how I use ls. All these applications down here, which is just the ones pretty much in the default build, a few interesting ones. Got an init thing. The kernel runs pretty much straight away. So this suggests, and we'll see on the next slide, you're pretty close to getting a Linux distribution that just runs right there. You've got an ints mod, despite certain keynotes this morning. The problem there, and let me just be fair, the problem with the ints mod here is it only works on a few architectures, and it's about a billion versions behind the currently distributed modutils version, because they took it out at 1.3 and have just basically... I should point out, the guys who mostly work on BusyBox are pretty interested in ARM-style processors, because they're in a lot of embedded devices. So BusyBox, out of the box, works on iX86, works on ARM. Everything else is a bit of a chook ruffle. Pardon? Is it, generally? Okay. But occasionally you get someone come in who tries to build it on some kind of architecture that hasn't been built on for a while, and there's a week or so of generally patching the build to just make it work. But it's not too bad. Yep. So you mean if the ash called sed or something, would it actually try and use the same binary? No, it just launches it as a separate process. Not completely sure. I think it must use vfork when it can. Because also the other thing to realize is a lot of this BusyBox in conjunction with UCLibC runs on certain architectures that don't have a memory management unit. So you can't just necessarily call your everyday run-of-the-mill malloc and expect it to work. I'm not entirely sure of the internally. Like it could be possible to just reuse the process, but then there's a whole bunch of re-entrancy issues inside and stuff like that. And they're so anal about bytes, right? Like, locking in. The sort of trade-off here, I should point out, is you're very much trading off a very low footprint installation model, so it fits on a tiny amount of RAM, a tiny amount of permanent storage, for slightly more space in RAM. Whether that's for better or worse kind of depends on your environment. But this sort of means you can dump it on a flash system or something, providing you've got a bit of RAM. You've got all those sort of cool tools like the Emacs of networking, little DHCP client in there. Oh. Yeah, and there's a little DHCP server in there too that you can build. Yes?
Just another clarifying flash file system, presumably you can do execution
twice? Presumably, again, that's getting down to the bit that scares me. That'll be the hardware level stuff again. way not my area of expertise. There's another one in here I was going to point out too, but I've lost it. Anyway, there's a truckload of tools there. Pretty much, like I said, I don't use all of those in my everyday run-of-the-mill stuff, and I do a fair bit of sysadmining. That's just to give you an idea. Like, really, this is just the teaser talk to give you an idea, maybe go away, play with this stuff. It is kind of cool. It doesn't take too long to build. So how good are they, right? I've claimed I give you something called LS, And I just mentioned that maybe it doesn't list the current directory if you're me, and you make a bozo error when you build it. But generally pretty good. What they've done is they've looked at the equivalent GNU tools and gone, which are the various features that have just been added because someone had too much spare time and we don't really need, throwing them away. What are the things we really need in everyday use for executing standard scripts? Because again, the whole idea here is you'd like to just be able to run your normal born shell scripts, your init scripts, your startup scripts, all that sort of stuff, and kept those options. You have a choice when you're building it whether you want to have the GNU style long options or just the short options. Adding the long options adds 40k or something to the binary because you've got a huge table of strings in there now that you didn't have before. They're not always exactly the same output for exactly the same options. So occasionally there's, like, there one variance is in the date command. It treats time zones slightly differently for the main reason that to add full GNU style date handling basically means you're going to have all of glibc's time zone handling stuff, which means you're going to have a lot more space than they're currently using. So they do a fairly good first order approximation to that. There is a test suite that you can run through if you're thinking of using this to say, okay, what are the differences in, well, what are the known differences? There are probably differences they haven't discovered yet. And you can just often make a case-by-case evaluation of, do I really want to, can I live with this or not? And the suck and see approach always works well. Just build it, run your scripts, see what works. There are a number of different shells, again, for the same reason. You may or may not require a lot of shell scripting. You may be quite willing to put up with hash or lash just because once in a blue moon you need to log into your box and do something. On the other hand, you may be, again, building a forensics disk or a rescue droplet or something, in which case you're probably going to go to town and blow the extra 50k there and put ash on it. The MSHA in the middle is kind of interesting. It's been in development for quite a while, but been in serious development for about a year. And it's slowly getting better and better. They started out saying, well, let's just forget about the size, so we're not going in BusyBox anytime soon, and just be correct, like go for Ash's sort of level of born shell correctness. And then we'll gradually shrink it down, and maybe we'll throw away a few features that aren't actually needed in scripts. So their idea is to be pretty correct, well, completely correct grammar-wise, maybe just missing a bit of the functionality of born shell. I should point out, too, if anyone went to my tutorial earlier in the week, the autoconf automate thing, I tend to run a lot of my shell scripts just under Ash or even under MSHA, because it tends to catch if you're using any bash-isms that aren't in born shell. They definitely aren't in there. Right? Yeah. Yeah, like anything like that. There's truckloads of them that you just running it under another shell, and these guys are the ultimate because they're not putting anything in there they don't have to. They're not putting some things in there they do have to. Okay, we had a nip. We got insmod. Got to be getting pretty close to something that boots here. All right, you need to add a kernel. Let's not fool ourselves here. You need to add an exet and a dev directory somehow. They haven't gone mad and put dev fsd into BusyBox yet. They have? Just recently? They've been talking about it, but it's been too big so far. Right. Yep, Mark? Yes, yeah, so I guess you could pre-populate the dev directory. Well, but there will be some scripts, for example, that want to talk to dev.hca or something like that, right? So yeah, you could fix the script. Okay, yes. So you could get away with dev.fs and not use dev.fsd and correct everything to be dev.fs friendly. That's not impossible. Yes. Okay. You will need a C library particularly if you're running other applications. So as we'll get to in a minute, we try and fix that problem without needing to put glibc on there necessarily. You don't get run levels just out of the, well, you don't get run levels with BusyBox. It's again for a special purpose style system mostly, rather than your everyday development desktop. If you want run levels, you build the sysv init package, or you build something like some other similar style thing to give you the run levels. I should point out, right out of the box, you don't need your accept directory. You probably want an fstab if you're going to mount proc or something. You don't need much else. You don't need any RC scripts in there. Given no RC scripts at all, the init process will basically do a default. It'll give you a shell on one terminal. I think it'll listen on a serial port. You've got shutdown and reboot. So you can literally dump a kernel, dump busybox, statically linked, make accept, pop fstab in there so you get proc, make dev that maybe has a few of your favorite devices, and it boots. That's pretty cool, actually. Like, you don't know why it boots. Like, you're wondering, but I've got all this other stuff on my Linux system. Surely, don't delete it off your Linux system just to see, because that won't Okay, so now we get to the next bit. If you're going to go a little bit beyond just the rescue floppy, say the Linux video recorder style model, you're going to be wanting to build other applications. Shared libraries start to make sense. So maybe don't statically link busybox here. UClibc is one of the reasonably popular small C libraries. There's other ones like dietlibc, newlibs floating around. Klib is not an option for anyone who went to Peter Amphin's talk. It's a very thin wrapper over the system calls. And you see this when we get to the next slide about the sort of sizes of things. Like, bear in mind, for those who went to Peter Amphin's talk, klibc is about 20k. UClibc is a little bit bigger. It's designed to run on embedded systems, in particular UC Linux, which is designed for memory management unitless systems, various embedded devices. This means they don't have a break system call, so malloc's done a bit differently with pre-reserved memory and stuff like that. So you've got a bit of choice when you're building it about how it does things like malloc. By default, it basically works. Again, my interest, well, this is just my hobby, so I just built it on my x86 box. So I do have a memory management unit. I haven't played on any hardware that doesn't. I just read stuff. We're practical, it's trying to be glibc to the application. They used to have a list on the UClibc page about all the applications that would build, just so people could see it was starting to get useful. They stopped that list. They've started another list of applications that won't build, because it just became easier to maintain it that way. You can build X against UClibc with only one very small patch. The gap is sort of closing on what they're missing that they want. Recently, within the last few months, wide character support worked. Locale support used to work, but has since been taken, it's still there, but it's been taken out of the build because Manuel Nova broke it somehow in ways that he doesn't seem to understand yet. And again, these are trade-offs. Like, if you're going to want to internationalize your applications, you suddenly need an awful lot more support in your C library. So you have to turn on various localization stuff. But if your application is just going to be in one language, and it can be handled even without wide characters, then leave it out. Save yourself all the kilobytes. And they've also started to document the differences, because it used to come down to a couple of developers knew what was different. The rest of us just scratched our heads and grepped through the source code. There is a reasonable body of software out there that wants to build against glibc, to the point of being antisocial and not building against other C libraries. So they always check for the, they sort of do if-def glibc style stuff. UClibc has taken this as a license to lie, and it also defines that saying, I really am libc, trust me, you can build against me. The reason for this, and I sort of agree with it, is it's slightly bad programming practice on the part of the applications to do this, am I building against glibc? Because they're not saying, I want to build against glibc, they're saying, I want to build against something that has this particular API and these interfaces and maybe these particular features. So it's typically being used as a feature check. It could be being used as a particular library check, like saying for ideological reasons, I only want to build against glibc and nothing else ever. but there doesn't seem to be any notable applications out there with that type of test. And if you really want to, you can turn it off. So it says, I'm not glibc. Good way of testing whether your application really does depend on glibc. In practice, again, I just sort of build it out of the box, left all the defaults on, unless I screwed it up, configured it so it worked on my system. Comes to about 360k. Remember the glibc one with everything, 8.5 meg? We've saved a little bit. On the other hand, we've just annoyed most of the non-English speaking world, because they're going to have to learn English. In fact, even the Norwegians, I think, are going to be unhappy because a couple of letters of theirs don't display well. You can add various things, like I've just added a sort of sample set down the bottom there of what's going on. You could add wide character support, so you can do double byte languages, various Japanese, Chinese encoding, stuff like that. VSPrintf, you can get a fairly much smaller, bit faster, and slightly broken version if you want, because it's missing two formatters, and it doesn't handle long longs very well or something in the format string. But basically, again, you judge what you're going to need it for. If you only need to print out sort of help, I'm on fire, then you don't need the full formatting strings. Maybe you want POSIX threading, maybe you don't. Again, it sort of depends on your memory management model. Adding the threading adds a lot of overheads. POSIX regular expressions adds about, well, I say big, and remember we're talking in the context of the 300K we've got to play with here. The library itself, I think, is 37K that you save by not having POSIX regular expressions. But that really sucks a bit, because your shell starts to look a lot less functional at that point. Like, you don't realize how often you hit that part of the library. Well, I didn't until I compiled it out. Get a choice of malloc implementations, like I said, depending on whether you've got a memory management unit or not. That doesn't really save your memory, but it means it actually runs on some systems. Finally, other ideas. If this has sort of inspired you to go out, build BusyBox, build UClibc, and you can literally grab them, like they pretty much build from CVS most of the time. If they don't, they're fixed the next day. I think BusyBox is about 11 megabytes from CVS and UClibc is about 16 meg. The tuples are sort of similar, but they change fast enough that I'd recommend going with CVS if you can, just because unless you really like downloading 16 megs a day, you can afford the bandwidth. They build pretty fast. On my laptop, which is a P3-800, I think UClibc takes about 5 or 10 minutes to build. BusyBox takes about 2 minutes to build. So it's not really tragic to just rebuild these things for experimenting. You can really go to town here too and go, okay, when you build UClibc, what happens by default is you get these little wrappers built for making GCC build and link applications against UClibc. Because, of course, once you've built this C library, you don't want to then go and build some other application and have it link against glibc. So you get these little wrappers for GCC. But they're occasionally a bit fiddly, and sometimes you get your system libraries leaking in. Like, someone sort of builds everything, it all goes happily, they move it over to their little sandbox environment, and things go a bit pear-shaped because there's some other library that's been accidentally linked in. They can be very hard to chase those sort of things out. So go to town, build GCC against UClibc. That's kind of educational, actually. Building GCC is fun when you can do it from the make scripts. It's more sort of educational slash time consuming when you have to do it a bit by hand. Because what really goes on here, just to give you the view from 3,000 feet, you build GCC once with a special variable configured so that it doesn't link against the C library. Then you build it again using that compiler that you've just built against UClibc. So now it's linked against the right C library, hopefully, and hasn't sucked anything else in. Then maybe you rebuild binutils if you're doing any sort of development that you, again, because they're currently linked against your normal C library, so you want to link them against UClibc. Then I think there's something that's wrong and you have to rebuild GCC again. There's something that's always sucked in still. The linker doesn't quite work properly or something, so you end up building GCC again. And it took me about a week the first time, But now I sort of understand how GCC builds itself. And like Rusty said, I'm sort of impressed with toolchain maintainers, because it's just the makefiles are scary. And to get it to build once and not link against a C library actually involves poking around randomly inside the makefile somewhere, because there's no way to just turn that off from the outside. Eric Anderson, the guy who maintains all this stuff, was actually kind of nice and got particularly, okay, the process I described, the week, gave me a C compiler. If you want to have a C++ compiler, take like a month off work, get up early, work hard. He actually built, there's sort of various patches needed to make it all work, so he's done some scripts to just download the latest version of BusyBox, latest version of UClibc, grabs a bin utils, just builds everything in the multiple paths, so it's sort of set and forget. Far less educational though, so don't do that. But if you really want it, it's easier. And I should point out here too, like the people doing a lot of this work, they develop on x86 boxes, they're building for ARMs or PowerPCs or whatever, so they're building cross-compilers. Building a cross-compiler is easier than building a compiler on x86 that builds for x86 that links against another library, because the build scripts actually know when you say my host is x86 and my target is ARM, it goes, wait, you're a cross-compiler, I don't want system native stuff. I want to use the stuff for the target environment. When you build it on x86, there's sort of no way to tell it that, and that's why it's a little bit fiddly. Build user mode Linux, which for those who haven't heard of it, is just a Linux binary. You essentially get a Linux binary that you can run as a normal user program, which is kind of cool, because when it crashes, you just kill it off. There's no crushing of the system. This is cool for many reasons, but you put BusyBox and UClibc and all the other stuff for your little mini video recorder or whatever just into a file system that you've mounted via loopback. So it's just a file normally. And you've got this ideal test environment. Pardon? Yeah, well, obviously until it crushes, but you, at least then you can, like the other cool things with GDB is if with UML is if something goes a bit pear-shaped, you can just attach GDB to it and go through. At that point, your life's got sort of interesting, because all three of those things I've mentioned there, user mode Linux, BusyBox, UClibc, are all under active development, in the sense that if you're user mode Linux particularly, there's no such thing as the stable release, right? It's just every release is a little bit more potluck than the last one and fixes a few more bugs, maybe introduces a few more. So you're talking about three things there that all may just have random bugs introduced from day to day. But in all three cases, great mailing lists, great maintainers, very good user community, and so you can usually get around all the problems if you're willing to show that you can do a bit of work and communicate well with others. I should point out too, if you're measuring your space and you're using user mode Linux, well, the default user mode Linux kernel is 8.5 meg. It's a bit bigger than the one you've got on your normal desktop. That's because it's got truckloads of debugging stuff in it. If you take out all the debugging stuff, it goes back to about 2 meg, sort of out of the box. You can make it bigger by not building all the modules in or whatever. So it's a little bit bigger than your normal kernel, but for development purposes, you're usually not counting the bytes of the kernel at that point. Don't worry about that later. And it runs 30% slower if you set everything up right, so it's not too bad. Build a small web server. I actually wanted to do this for this talk and run the slides off a web server that was running as a user mode Linux process on my box, but things interfered. A few too many glasses of wine last night, stuff like that. Is there a typo there? Oh, no. BusyBox comes with a web server in it. One of the things you can turn on is an HTTPD. That will basically serve up static pages. It will serve up anything that starts with CGI-bin. It will run the script that's then referenced. So it's not Apache, right? But you can do IP sort of access control based on IP addresses and ranges and stuff like that. It's not bad for a sort of serving pages. I've actually set one of these up just as a see if you could style thing as a sort of convention demo type thing. If you want to just have a box that was running on a big plasma screen or something, just running through various things. Because the beauty there would be if anything goes wrong, power cycle, right? Sort of one of the nice things with these small Linuxes, they just reboot really fast. So if you've got a dedicated box and it doesn't take too long to build one, then you usually don't have to worry about stuff like, oh, how can I fix it when it's gone wrong? Reboot. Go the Microsoft route. THTTPD, terrible to pronounce. They've got Sylvester the Cat as their logo, as their mascot. Is a very small web server, but very functional. It's also not Apache, right? There's certain things in Apache that aren't in this. There are certain things in THTTPD that are not in Apache. It can do service and IP-based traffic volume throttling. So you can throttle certain domains or certain ranges based on their identification or based on the type of traffic. A little bit more flexible than the Apache traffic control module. So you can build a very functional web server like that. And the cool thing is, this is so small, you can buy, and I'm venturing into hardware here, but this one I sort of know what I'm talking about a little bit. You can buy a little sort of PC-104 board with a 486DX style chip on it and a little bit of memory and a flash card. You've got a web server that's about sort of yay big, and it can do fairly powerful stuff. Your main problem at that point is where to store all your web pages. You've got to maybe NFS mount something or stuff like that. The other one I haven't mentioned here actually is this sort of stuff is also pretty cool for booting over a network, because there's not a lot of stuff. You have to transfer over the network for everything to run. So you set up your PXE, pre-execution environment, in your Ethernet card so it can boot via BootP or something. Pretty much can transfer the whole system over the Odysseus terminal that might have 64 meg, 128 meg of RAM. You've got a really fast small box for doing whatever, watching videos, music box, like as a jukebox or something, little kiosk box in a internet cafe where you might just want to offer web browsing. Again, when the user logs out, just resuck the image in over the network, essentially reboot. Build a little X server. Again, build the X386 thing, which you can do with all of this. It takes a little while, but you can do it. That doesn't run too badly. Build something like NanoX, which is a little frame buffer based X server. Doesn't have the full X session protocols, isn't source code compatible in any way with X11 R6 style code, but it's not hard to write wrappers for everything. There was at one point a fairly well-maintained GTK NanoX port, but it got unmaintained and dropped recently. But that's kind of cool for, again, very small systems with maybe small screens. You can run, when you're testing NanoX, you can actually test it by running it on your X server. Runs pretty slowly, I found, which may just be some artifact on my graphics card or something, but it's only slow on redraws. It runs much faster when you just set it on the hardware. And occasionally you do it crazy. If you're running in user mode Linux, you maybe have the user mode Linux session talking through an XNX server on which you're running your test NanoX thing. You've got a few layers of abstraction there. Gets a little bit, frame rate's not so good, but it's good for testing. So probably stop there. In fact, I think, yeah, wahoo. Right. Any questions about this sort of stuff? Like I said, it's mostly inspirational rather than too much concrete. Yes? I wasn't at last year's conference. The question was, last year at the conference, there was a talk about a 70 megabyte, also tarball, essentially building a...
I think that was microcontroller.
Like, it's certainly not, it certainly is no advancing technology at all beyond what I'm talking about here. Like the tools, this is sort of this talk, is to give you an idea. The tools are out there. They're accessible to a bozo like me. Like, I can build them in half a day now. You can really go to town on your own distro here, and it's heaps of fun. But no, sorry, no one seems to know much. Other questions? Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. You see Linux, which is the next level on top of this, which is again a sort of Linux distribution for embedded stuff. They have a very similar sort of click here to build your Linux distribution. And again, it has the same problem Anthony talks about. Change one thing, you're rebuilding the tree. Right. So, okay, you learn to be careful. Any other questions? Yes? Absolutely. Yeah, because then you just got heaps of storage space or whatever. Like I need to have a few of these, not on this thing, but on my machine at home. I've just got a directory which are basically full of file images that are sort of 10 megabyte, 20 megabyte files that I can mount, loop back, and boot in user mode Linux, and they're all just little distros. It's kind of cool to have about 15 machines up and running on your system at once. but yeah, you could by all means just make it your main system. Like I said, you can build X using uclibc and Busybox and everything and have that all running. So if you've got a 40 megabyte hard drive or a 20 megabyte hard drive where space is tight, you can still get a pretty good desktop. You're struggling to fit X into 20 meg there, I think. So you're not having a lot of storage space after that. Anything else? By all means, come up and see me later on today or whatever, too. Okay, thank you.